Do you want to intro the show?
What is that? What we do? I don't even. I guess we don't have a thing yet.
No.
Welcome to the Co-Pilots. It's our energy.
Yeah.
I'm Andrew Secunda.
My name is Sean Conroy.
My guest today is Sean Conroy.
Thank you.
So let's get into the thing. The thing being the pilot.
The pilot being Pen 15.
Oh, see, I was trying to tee you up.
Okay.
It doesn't even matter.
No.
Okay, it's Pen 15.
Cut,
not pretend that we have any kind of rhythm or elegance or way that it, we're going
to
leave
up,
them
set
in.
Me up to set. Go ahead.
Basically, if we were an old-timey, you know, Catskill show, this would be the equivalent of just each of us stumbling out at some point where the audience was half filling the theater.
Mr. Brown, where are you? Hey, everybody. Welcome to Co-Pilots. I am Sean Conroy.
And I'm Andy Secunda.
On this podcast, we talk about TV pilots, the first episodes of television shows. Sometimes pilots become long-running series. Others don't make it past that first episode.
We're going to talk about all of them. The great pilots, the bad pilots, the weird pilots, the forgotten pilots. We are TV writers, but it should be noted that we are the dumbest TV writers you know. So all these are just our dumb opinions.
So dumb.
The way I thought we would start today is that you're the one who said this is what you would like to do next.
Mm-hmm.
You have a passionate feeling about this show. This is a show that I've certainly heard from all ages across the spectrum, people saying they love this show. They're obsessed with it. I've seen one episode of it from a friend who wanted to show it to me.
You had not seen the pilot.
I had not seen the pilot. I thought it was amazing. I just had other things that I sort of was prioritizing to watch. So this was the first time I'd seen this pilot.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to hear your entry point into this show and your experiences with it.
I don't remember why I watched it the first time. I don't know what caused me to go, here's a show that might be interesting. But whatever it was, from the moment the show started, it hit very hard for me.
Right.
You know, it just very, I very much identified as a millennial 12-year-old girl, you know.
Really spoke to your experience.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, just to get into it, that is the most amazing thing about it is that it's so, it could not be more specific. It's these two women's perspective and their experiences, even if they weren't friends in high school. But it really is emblematic of the universality of it in that it's like, you know, they weren't the same generation as me. I wasn't a teenage girl. And it's just like, it's just putting a finger on that awkwardness of being a teenager, particularly an early teenager. And it just nails it.
Yeah. I mean, I had a couple thoughts. Like, is there something, because for me, seventh grade was so specific in a variety of ways. Is there something about that specific year that's universal, or is it more just around that age you have that feeling? And I also was thinking about it in terms of, like, I don't know if this is true of everybody, but certainly for me, there are still times that I feel that way in life, you know, with anytime going into a new situation with a group of people. Anyway.
Yeah, well, for me, the aspect of that age that it's so evocative and rich, and I think this is also the game, if you will, in improv terms of the show to me, because it is like so many things are so searingly painful and upsetting in the show about how they're treated or their hopes and dreams that are dashed or their, you know, this deep feeling of alienation. Is the counterbalancing thing is the game of the show, which is they're cocky. They're so emboldened, and they embolden each other in such an atypical way to that age. And to me, that grows out of that these are 13-year-olds that are like, we're adult women now. We are adults.
Because we're in seventh grade.
Exactly. And we're going to be awesome now. Now it's all going to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going to be powerful. Now we're going to be attractive. And now we're going to be popular. It's this illusion of future potential that is about to be realized, which of course is untrue at 13 years old.
For most people.
For most people.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was great.
Well, these are always the contrast between Sean and my stories.
I just felt like there were so many
things. Football king at 13.
How was he the starting quarterback on the local college team?
The only 13-year-old prom king.
But that is part of the specificity of it is there are so many moments, just moments in the pilot that I'm like, that exact thing or feeling or whatever is so relatable to me from that time in my life.
Do you want to just crack open the pilot and get into it? Or
yeah,
do you
yeah.
want to? Because I'm
yeah,
sure let's... you'll have moments to touch on like
I
that.
I mean, just to what you were just saying, the cold open is them basically saying, we are now adult women. We are going to rule the world. You
right.
know? Like they're having a conversation on the phone and they're sort of going, this is going to be the best year of our lives.
Right.
It took me a while to figure this out. And when I say a while, I mean several watchings of the show.
Yeah.
Because I was seeing it through my own experience where I went into seventh grade as a new student in a new school. And that's not what these guys are doing. They no. are coming back to the same school for seventh grade.
Right. And I never at any point, not even my senior year, did I feel like I'm going to be the guy this year.
Right.
I was always sort of a malcontent. Right. Even when I became more popular, I was still sort of somehow guarded my outsider position.
Right.
So I never really had that, which is why it's so fascinating to me to view it through their eyes. And I wonder if that grows from you have your one person that is basically, it's almost like a cult situation of like feeding whatever narrative you are telling yourself.
You're saying because their relationship is so almost Shark and Remora or something like that. Like not parasitic, but they're both so... I mean, that's one of the things I love about the show is how their friendship is so close and so self-reinforcing. But you're saying that in some ways that might be the thing that puts them in this headspace of like, it's all going to work out. We're doing great.
Yes. And you could argue it's both. Like their fatal flaw mm-hmm. is their ability to delude each other. Mm-hmm. And it is also the saving grace of them as a duo because they're there to support each other. Their friendship is true and pure and they stand by each other.
There's that awful moment of like realizing that she has been sort of nominated for ugliest girl in school.
Right.
And
she'd be nominated or she'd been elected.
I don't think it was a formal vote that was taken. Okay. It was just kind of a
general.
But they were going to put her name on the list, which she didn't find out until later, but there was an actual list.
Right.
And to speak to your point of how cocky they are, she sort of takes it in stride when they say like, oh, these guys really like you. They think your haircut is amazing. And she turns around to her friend and says, it's all happening. They're like, it's happening. We're all, it's
right.
all.
Everything we wanted is coming together.
Yeah, yeah. And then they find out that that's not actually the case, and that she's been elected or nominated or selected or chosen or whatever as ugliest girl in school, and she's so upset and she's furious and she's depressed and she's, you know, just feels awful. Obviously, as anybody would in that situation, and feels like her friend doesn't get it. Maya feels like Anna doesn't get it. And she's like, don't you get it? This is the worst, you know, being named the ugliest girl in school is the worst, you know, whatever. And Anna says, I didn't write down what she says, but she basically says, I guess I've been insulted the worst because she's basically saying, I love you. I'm your friend.
Right.
And it's this incredible moment of like support and affection between them. You
right.
know?
And what's impressive also is that they, you kind of feel a lot of the turns coming. And a lot of them are sort of like, you know, they got the bullies and facing off with the bullies. There's a lot of aspects that actually harken back, not just in general to high school stories and high school pilots, but specifically Freaks and Geeks. They have a big bully pilot. They have a thing, a bully plot. They have, you know, stuff with the crushes. It's all these sort of standby tropes. But what's impressive here is you know, all right, well, it's not just going to be that, you know, that these boys like her and that everything's great and that her haircut worked out.
I would go even farther than that because that moment where they talk about her haircut and how great it looks, and you know, it's like hearing the music in Jaws,
right?
You know, you're like, oh god, this
right?
Is
what's
go
coming?
So...
And your stomach starts to tighten.
Oh.
Yeah, but here's what I'm here's my point. Even though you feel that coming, which would sort of to some degree numb out what your reaction,
mm-hmm.
they go so hard in the Ugis. Is that what they
Ugis?
Ugis, yes. Mm-hmm. Funny pronunciation.
I guess you know there's that's the more colloquial pronunciation is Ugis.
I guess it depends what you know what town you're from.
What part
you know,
of the
probably,
country?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's like online versus inline. You know.
But yeah, when that comes up, and that is what it is. It's so much worse than anything you could have possibly imagined. Mm-hmm. And it really is just like, oh, God, no, no, Maya, no.
So, go back to the cold open,
great.
Which they're, you know, they're just looking at their yearbook. They're talking about who got boobs at camp. Camp was such a big thing at that time. I don't know. Did you go to camp in summertime when you were a kid?
I did. I hated it.
Yeah, I never.
As one might expect.
I was never allowed to go except for 1 year. When my parents couldn't afford to pay for the full month,
uh-huh.
so they paid for the second half of the month.
Oof, not even the first half.
So by the time I got there, everybody was already best friends with each other.
And what that, see, that tells me is they were like, well, we're going to want a break after 2 weeks, so let's make it halfway through the month, which, of course, puts you behind the eight ball.
Well, and to be fair, it was only a day camp. Like, it wasn't a sleepaway camp, so I never even went
to
a
sleepaway camp. How do you think you would have probably done better at sleepaway camp than I did? For me, I was such a sort of homebody even as a child that I was sort of like, I don't want to go to a place where I'm sleeping in a room with a bunch of other people.
I think I would have been very scared, but I think it would have worked out okay.
Yeah.
You know? But instead, I went to this second half of this camp for 2 weeks where they basically tried to drown me while I was there. Every day they would hold me underwater in the pool.
Oh, real hardcore.
And I also could not open the lock to my locker. I always had to go get somebody. I never figured out how to do a combination lock, you know.
Yeah.
I was very young. It was like 11th grade.
And that's why Conroy went into comedy. So you had not sprouted at that point, or you had they were holding this very tall person.
It was like fourth or fifth grade, so I was not a big kid by then.
Okay.
And even when I sprouted, I mean by the time I graduated from high school, I was very tall, but I weighed like 108 pounds. Like I didn't get fat until much later, you know. But anyway. So they're in their rooms, they're talking about the yearbook, they're talking about who got boobs at camp and who did what with who. And then I think it's my favorite moment, only because of the specificity of it, and it brought so much rushing back to me, even though I wasn't in school at that time, is the moment when they're talking on the phone and you hear the modem kick in because the brother is trying to get on AOL.
Yeah.
And she starts screaming. Maya starts screaming into the phone because she's so annoyed. And Anna realizes that Maya's not even paying attention to her anymore. And you just see the expression on her face. It's just a brilliant moment.
It's also a thing that would be in any period show. And I've written on the Goldberg, so I know a lot about this. But you know, it's Goldberg's. We just didn't hide it. We just went right for it. We set up, hey, this is the touchstone we're going to be attacking in this episode. And then you know, maybe there are other things along the way. But this is sort of a fun version of this because they deal with this emotional scene. And, you know, Maya saying, do you think I've changed at all? You know, in the off season, is that what you call it when you're not at school?
Yeah.
And it's like this really deep connection that is interrupted by this thing that is just a touchstone of AOL setting the time immediately,
right.
Which is such a great, quick way to do it. That's, you know, almost underlining the trope of this is, you know, we're using our temporal touchstone here.
Right. I mean, they set it up as 2000 right from the beginning because you see the yearbook that they're looking at is that year.
Yeah.
But the visceral sound of the thing, for me, it just brought me back to that time, you know, of like, oh my God, yes, you know?
Yeah.
And my brother, you know, Shuji was always on the
Oh, you really had a lot of crossovers.
It was quite an experience. So then we're out of the cold open, we're into the opening, you know, now we're setting the world, because before it was just the two of them in their bedrooms. Now we have to go outside the world. And it's Maya's haircut. She has fucked it up in the middle of the night, and she gets help from her mother. They get in the car because they're carpooling on their way to school. There's just so many great, funny little moments over the course of their
The haircut concert. In and of itself is such a great, like,
yeah.
She has, the cockiness, the hubris of, I'm going to cut my own hair. It looks awesome.
Yeah.
And fighting her mother on cutting it, but she can see what's coming. And right. Her mother giving her the worst possible version that's like for a woman like, you know, 5 to 7 years younger than.
Right. And she's. It really makes me laugh so hard every time. Just screaming.
I had that haircut at some point.
Oh, yes. I mean, literally, I have 4 younger brothers. We all had that haircut.
Sure.
All at the same time for my entire childhood.
Yeah.
When I say childhood, I'm talking about until I went away to college, basically. Right. I had that haircut.
Just, can you give me the Marcy from Peanuts is right. What they would ask.
But...
Marcy was a side character in Peanuts who was always wore glasses. That was the theme. So.
And then there's, you know, such great interplay. I mean, one of the things that I think is really hard in a pilot, and I always focus on this, is defining the relationships differently between different characters. Like, everybody feels differently about different people. In this room, there are 3 people right now. I do not care... For you,
sure.
Kevin is appealing, not my best friend,
right.
But we're getting there.
Right.
You know?
Do you think my presence is holding back your ability to connect more with him?
I don't even think about your presence.
Oh, okay. Well, just
not holding anything back.
Okay, then I'm glad about that.
But there's such a great dynamic between Maya and Anna and Shuji.
Yeah.
Where as soon as Shuji gets in the car and calls, I forget what he calls Maya, like an idiot or something like that.
Yeah.
She's like, don't call me that. And Anna immediately takes Shuji's side and is like, move your bag, Maya. Like,
right.
She's so on board with anything Shuji says.
Right. And you can see that she has a crush on him and she's trying to engage him. And
And setting those relationships up so quickly is just an incredible art unto itself in a pilot, and they do it so well in this. And then Sam comes in, and he has a specific relationship with everybody, except not really with Shuji, which is kind of specific too. Like, Shuji is too cool for Sam, you know?
Right. There's another, yeah. There's so many different, very subtle distinctions in tone of a teenager at that age, mm-hmm. of like, and they're all... What's so authentic about this is, except for Anna and Maya, they all have that, and this is what, again, the brilliance of casting these actual 13-year-olds, is they all have that kind of blank haze over their eyes, mm-hmm. of just like being slightly disconnected or overwhelmed by every situation, and thus they can't really engage fully in them.
Which also allows Anna and Maya... to project whatever they want to on these people.
And which is why it makes sense for them to be, you know, 35-year-old women playing 13-year-olds, because it really gets to the heart of what outsiders, what aliens they really are. I assume everyone who is listening to this has seen the pilot, but do we need to stack to some degree the pretense of this show?
I think we should restack it.
Let's restack mm-hmm. the pretense. Well, we haven't stacked it already.
Okay, yet. So stack it.
Yes, we can't restack it until we...
Get Stackhouse in here. Which one? Jerry, the NBA player. So what's the premise of the show?
You're the fan.
Just that 2 girls who are best friends are going into the 7th grade and what's going on with them. And then... the thing I think you're looking for is that they are played by 30-something-year-old women.
Maya Erskine and Anna Conkel.
Whereas all the other characters are actually played by kids. It's sort of the reverse of your classic, you know, Dawson's Creek or something, where all the teenagers are played by 46-year-old hot people, you know?
Yeah, which is like a great, and I don't even know that that is their intended parody. I think from quick research on them, they came from kind of a performance art background and then kind of made their way into comedy. And it has that feeling of something, of a choice that's like, we want to play with the themes and the emotion through this device, as opposed to we're commenting in a meta way on this other form. That's how Freaks and Geeks did, was sort of commenting in a meta way on the alternative type teenage show and then built out from there to the emotion. But this really makes it feel authentic to come straight from the emotion and then make that weird choice and then build all the details around it. They created it with Sam Zwiebelman. I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that correctly.
Eugis.
And to step back for a second, one of the things that I'm always the most intrigued by is, how did they sell this?
Yeah.
Because they weren't names. Now they are. They weren't names. How do you get someone to sort of take a leap on this? I don't know the exact chronology, but essentially, they had just written this as a script. It had gotten over to Party Over Here, which is...
Lonely Island.
And
production company.
Right, which is...
Who had a deal with somebody that they were supposed to be looking for stuff to make sizzle reels of, basically, is my understanding.
Right, sort of in the vicinity of 100K budget,
right,
kind of short presentations, which are sort of almost as long as a pilot, which this would be perfect for because it's very shootable. And I'm sure there were many other hands involved. The two things to me are like, oh, Lonely Island's involved and they can kind of push it through at that moment. And secondly, that it's, they have their proof of concept. Because otherwise, I don't know how you sell this other than if they had done a stage show, which I knew before that they had not done a stage show with them doing.
Right. The other factor that I don't know how much it played in, but it was something that occurred to me this morning when I was thinking about the show. Like, I wonder how closely connected this was. And then when I was reading about it this afternoon, there was actually mention of the fact that Broad City had just come out with Alana and Abby, and people were like, we got to get the next female comedy duo. And these guys had just made a web series after that and then come out with this idea for their show. So,
which is a perfect thing to build on if you're in the mind of Broad City,
right?
To be like, oh, what's something that feels like it might be the similar sensibility, but it's a different thing.
And best friends, they're both girls, they're weird, like it's interesting,
right?
And they just came along at the right time and sort of nailed it, and you know, did an incredible job of putting something together that obviously worked for people. But it was, it's always interesting that there's a timing aspect to these things as well.
100%. And that's, of course, why it's hard to sort of reverse engineer and kind of think, oh, I'm going to write this, because it's sometimes it's just like, we're looking for this thing right now and nobody sold it to us yet.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, they just had the right turn of the cards, that the thing that they created that was so true to them happened to fit the marketplace perfectly at that moment. The other thing is, that's to me what's so impressive about this in general, is that it feels fully baked. This very strange pilot, this very strange world and tone, it feels like they have a complete handle on it. And I think a lot of that does come in the same way that the characters feed each other's, you know, narrative from Erskine and Conkle, kind of like they'd been friends for over a decade. They knew each other's sensibilities. They had a shared sensibility for whatever the distinctions between their sensibilities were. And that's why it feels baked. And they also have a cinematic sensibility that I think is, like, there are little touches in this pilot.
Well, let me just interrupt you for one second, because I want to talk more about what you were just talking about. Then we can talk about the weird stuff that happens when they get out of the car at the school and everything, which is amazing. But one of the things that hits me over and over again when I'm reading about these things or looking at them is, I think they wrote a pilot script that was like 60 pages long at the beginning of this process. And I read somewhere that it took them from start to actually shooting was like a 6-year period of time.
Oh, that's amazing. I did
and
not.
And so it's that element, and I've talked about this before, of like really believing in your idea. And they had a whole other idea for what they wanted to do, which was they wanted to be women who had escaped from a cult and were hiding from the cult as junior high school students.
Right.
So they would have been playing adult women pretending to be junior high school students. So right. That is the part of it that stuck when they sort of started to put this idea together and strip away what wasn't working from their other idea.
Right. And I believe it's Sam Zweibelman, who was sort of their writer, director, collaborator, was one who said, you know what, let's do this again and just strip out the pretense of the cult and you guys are just in high school.
Right.
Which is, again, that's an additional thing of having a third pair of eyes that sometimes you're so much in it, particularly if you have a shared sensibility, it's like you and the other person, that you need a third pair of eyes to go, I think we should just strip that out. And then to the thing you're saying about the length of time it took from the beginning to the end, that's another thing of like that journey allows you to incubate that idea to such a degree that often in a development process, you don't have that opportunity. Or you don't have the opportunity to do it in a way where it stays true to what you feel are the right artistic choices. So it really, that's why you enter this world and it's like, you're thrown right into the pool and it's like, this is unsettling and touching and weird, but they know what they're doing.
Which brings us back to the cinematic touches in the opening sequence at the school, which they insist. It's echoed later in a funnier way, but there's the moment where they step out of the car together and they have to do it at the same time.
Yeah.
And I say it's echoed in a funnier way later because she says, we have to be together when we get our first fingers.
Right.
Which is just a hilarious
so thing amazing. To me.
But so they go through, they're walking up to school the first day of school and they have all sorts of, there's the music that comes in, which I think is maybe lit or something.
That's right. Yeah. My Own Worst Enemy.
And then they see the girl whose breasts they've been talking about and her breasts are gigantic.
Right. Which I think is their way of cueing off because you almost feel a sensation of discomfort and concern when they start talking about the 13-year-old's breasts. You're right. Like, uh-oh, what is this show going to be doing?
Right.
And then they make it these comically...
that are clearly not the little girl playing
right.
the character.
So it's like, oh, that's how we're going to deal with
it's
these
their
kinds
point
of moments.
View, right. Not what's really going on.
Right. And by the same token, later on, when it's Dustin that they're looking at, one of the boys that Maya's fixated on, and he's just none of the kids. Some of the kids are like, oh, you can see them as the popular kid. Most of them are like just
lumps.
Yeah, they're just these either scrawny or awkward, or it's just like, yeah, that's what a 13-year-old would think. Like, that's the hottest person in school.
Yeah, yeah.
But one of the ways that they communicate it is Dustin sort of just turns around and they talk about his earring and how much they like it, and then the earring has a little bling. Little glimmer. It's like, yeah, that's what they would see.
Yeah. So they go in and we see a little bit of them in the school in class. I think that's where we have the teacher playing the guitar, which is reminiscent of Dustin Hoffman on The Simpsons.
That's right. You're saying they stole it.
I'm saying it's been done.
Okay. Yeah. And that's all we have to say. We talk until Sean hits a point where he's like, you've blown it. You're out of the running for best pilot.
I will also say that guy was no Dustin Hoffman.
well, it's not a fair comparison for anyone.
nobody's Dustin Hoffman.
You, sir, are no Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah. And by the end of that sequence...
Dated reference.
We find out, yes, nothing better than 1996 politics.
I would say somebody hit the dated reference jingle, but yeah, that will be constant in this podcast.
We'll never stop. But they come out of class, and there's all kinds of signs hanging on the lockers
right.
about how Brant loves Maya and Dustin loves Maya.
Now, Becca's the one who comes in and explains it to them. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the moment that Sean was describing before, where they're like, they don't question it for a second. Maybe a little bit, but then they're like, this is it. This is what we were been waiting for.
Right.
So my question to you about Becca, because mm-hmm. I think it's Becca that both tells them this and then drops the reality on them
correct.
Later. Does Becca know?
Absolutely.
Yes.
So
this is just flat out cruelty.
Well, that's what makes the second moment so heartbreaking
right.
is that Becca is reveling in telling Maya she's been taken.
Right.
And she's about to be named Ugis or Ugis, whichever Becca chooses to pronounce it as. But she's going to be the Ugis of the school. And Becca
right.
loves being able to tell her that.
Right.
But she's doing it in such a way that it forces Maya, as her heart is breaking,
right.
to thank Becca and tell her that she appreciates it and that it's funny that she's going to be called Ugis.
What a performance also by Maya Erskine. That
oh
she's
my
like,
God.
That she's has to be polite. The tears are welling up in her eyes. It's
she's like,
just
that's really cool. That's really funny.
Oh, man.
It's amazing.
What a great choice also for her to sort of polite her way out of it.
I turned to the person I was watching it with and I was like, there are so many things in this show that are so hilarious to me.
Yeah.
But there's always at least one moment in every episode where my heart just absolutely snaps in half. You know?
And I turned to the person I was, oh.
Well.
Anyway, what are we talking about?
Yeah. We're still in the part where she's getting sucked in.
Yes.
And that's what makes it so great is she 100% believes that these boys are in love with her and that all she has to do is choose one and that will be her boyfriend henceforward till the end of days.
I always try to avoid spoilers. I will probably watch this series at some point. But can you tell me... Mm-hmm. Is it explained? It's funny that this is the thing I'm asking about because often my questions in a show are like, and do we find out where his powers are from? Do we find out his origin story? But here's my question.
His father was Kal-El.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah.
So his father was Superman. That's who you're referring to, you know?
I guess.
You were thinking of Jor-El.
Yes.
Oh, boy, Sean. There's really egg on your face
thinking,
in this
I was actually thinking of Marlon Brando.
Yeah, that would be Jor-El.
Not Russell Crowe.
What was I talking about? Oh, yeah. Do we find out why they have this hubris? Is there any kind of like frame of how their parents treat them or whatever that's sort of like, oh, that's why?
I don't think so. I think that's just who they are.
It's just who they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just how they are. I think it's a friendship, really. It's like they love each other so much that they enable each other
right.
to feel good about their place in the world.
Right. It's like what I said is that just both their fatal flaw and their strength come
yeah.
from the same thing, which is their...
It's like very sweet that they care that much about each other, but it also causes them to be blind to the reality sometimes.
That's so amazing.
So now we know that Maya is, you know, her hubris has the wheel of hubris is about to come crashing down.
Oh, before we get past that moment,
yeah, yeah.
is that the moment... Yes, it's because it's when Becca comes up to them and they're talking about it and Maya's like, I know, you guys, I'm losing my mind right now. Kind of almost being like fake
when
humble.
When she went to the Salon Supreme for
right.
her haircut.
When she lies about where she got her haircut
yeah.
and she turns back and makes that face at Anna, which is like beautiful. And one of the things that I love about this stylistically is they hit this kind of quick, kind of almost boy bandish music sting that cuts off hard in the middle of it and they go to black. So it's almost an awkward kind of
yeah.
like music cut that like it also implies danger and something ominous, but it's also just a weird cut.
Here comes Bruce the Shark. Yeah. So then we come back and we're in, well, I guess it starts in the locker room, right? With the classic gym teacher character who's like, you think you're better than me or whatever,
right.
you know? Which is exactly like every seventh grade gym teacher.
Right.
Mr. Rendy was the guy.
Was yours?
Yeah. And he did not like me.
What was his big complaint?
Well, he knew
Sean.
My father and he knew I was better than how I was behaving.
Oh.
Yeah.
He gave credit to your father. It's sort
yeah.
of a reverse back yeah. to the future.
And then I did terribly in the free throw shooting test and he was going to fail me for seventh grade.
Was your father a great athlete?
No. But he was the principal of a high school that Mr. Rendy had worked at.
Oh, sure.
No. It was about behavior. It wasn't about athletic performance.
Gotcha.
But then they're in the, you know, playing kickball outside, and there's that incredible... First, there's the really funny moments of them just looking at these boys and projecting so much onto them. And again, a very effective use of sort of cheesy soundtrack music.
Yeah.
You know, where Maya is just looking at the back of this kid's neck and listening to, I don't know what, 98 Degrees or who knows who it is.
The back of the neck is another moment of such specificity of that's what a teenage girl might look at. That's a very specific fetishization. it's very unique to Maya. Mm-hmm. It's just great. And it's weird. It makes you uncomfortable, but it's also like, yeah, I can see that she would be into it.
Right. Of course, Anna kicks the ball right into Alex's nose.
Right.
And just the crush, like the feeling of doing something like that. And that's one of those moments where I relate to that so hard.
Right.
Because when I was in sixth grade, there was a girl. I was in love with her.
Uh-huh.
I never told her.
Okay.
She knew.
She'll know now.
She did know then.
Oh, she did know then.
I thought it would be funny at one point.
This is going to be...
This is a horrific story, by the way. Just
no, I think this
trigger
is...
warning.
Okay.
She dropped
Hear
her...
Hear the Jaws music.
She dropped her pencil on the ground.
Okay.
And I thought it would be funny to... kick it out of the way with my foot to nudge it aside as she was reaching for it.
Sure.
I fucked it up and I kicked it
right into her hand. Oh no.
It just went right into the webbing between her thumb and her pointer finger. And she went, "Ow, you fucker."
Oh.
And that was my equivalent moment with Anna, where I was like, I can't believe I just
her lead
did
poisoning.
That. What's that?
You might have given her lead poisoning.
But I literally did the exact same thing. I went down to the nurse's office with her. Like, it was the same fucking thing. And she told me in that moment.
Yeah.
She was like, "Dustin is a bitch."
That's what she said. It's weird. The same thing.
Yeah.
What's really the greatest shame of that story is you had an ironclad comedy bit. Like, you were going to kick the pencil.
Never doesn't work. Never does not work.
It's just happenstance that it didn't.
Say, Mr. Green, I see you're reaching for that pencil.
If you had had a second take, that
would
have become...
Mr. Brown. Look.
Dated comedy.
We don't
reference.
We don't know what's going to work and what's not
going to
work.
Further and further back, we're going to the Vaudeville now.
I say, Mr. Barrymore.
Yes?
So anyway, Anna has nailed this kid in the face with a kickball. She goes to the office with him, the nurse's office, and he tells her that Dustin is a bitch.
Another thing that I like that's sort of a left turn, because you could argue that maybe that her kicking him in the face with a kickball is slightly more in the tropey direction, is then the conversation between them is not this giant disaster. Like, she's being weird and putting a tremendous amount of pressure on him, but he can't even process it. So it's not even like it ruins their relationship.
Right.
He's just like a 13-year-old boy. He's just like, I don't know. Oh, you're talking about Dustin. That's the only
Dustin's
thing I understand
bitch.
In this conversation.
Yeah. So Anna has to run back and tell Maya the choice is easy between Brant and Dustin because Dustin's a bitch.
Right. And the thing that drives that primarily
is that she wants to be in the same room when they get fingered.
So that Alex and Brant or whoever the other person's has to have to be with, you know, people that like each other.
Right. Right.
Because obviously you wouldn't finger someone in a
room
with
somebody you don't like.
No.
Yeah. I never got fingered in seventh grade.
Hey, Sean.
Yeah.
I see you.
Thank you.
No problem.
So Maya and Anna conspire to send a note to Brant that Maya has made her choice. I guess there's two real Pen 15 moments to me in the show. Do you know the whole thing with Pen 15?
I do, but please explain.
So I did not know this, and I was like, what's the big deal about Pen 15? Like, why do we care that somebody isn't writing the word penis, that they're writing pen 15.
For the diehard spoiler people, this is a very minor spoiler. As a someone who worries about spoilers, I don't feel like it's that big an issue, but skip ahead if you're concerned.
It turns out that what you do is you ask someone if they want to be in the pen 15 club, and if they say yes, you say, we just have to write pen 15 on your... I've heard hand, I've also heard forehead. We write pen 15 on your forehead, and that way it looks like it says penis on your forehead.
Right.
And to me, the biggest pen 15 moments on the show in this episode, because they never reference that at all.
Right. Well, that's, again, another astonishing thing about this pilot, is they don't explain the title, which is a very specific title to the meaning of the show.
And I literally had seen the pilot like 3 or 4 times before I ever even understood what that was. But first of all, it's the thing of like telling Maya these guys want to go out with her, and then it turns out that they want to name her Eugis instead.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, in this moment when Maya has written a note to Brandt, and Anna changes the whole note so that it's much more in little abbreviations, right, and arrows and whatever.
It's what's like, also brilliant about that is that will play for the modern audience, mm-hmm, for the younger modern audience that only knows texting, because it's very much like constructing a text to, you know, to communicate the
emojis,
right level of yeah, breeziness.
Right.
Except it's analog.
Right. So she sends the note, and that's when we have the scene in the hallway where Maya finds out that, in fact... First, Brandt says, Dustin loves you. He says yes. Then Dustin says, Brandt says yes. And then Becca does Maya the kindness of explaining to her that actually they've been fucking with her so hard the whole time, and they're going to name her the ugliest girl in school.
And I would give credit to casting, which is just an amazing job. And one has to say, the casting by Melissa Delizia, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Melissa, if you're listening and that's not how you say it, apologies.
Call into the tip line. We usually use it for
1-800-555-COPILOTS.
doesn't work. Too many letters. But maybe we'll snag that. Anyway, just genius, just so adept and amazing, especially with kid actors, where it's not like you're going to a known quantity as most of the time, even though I assume that they have had some jobs before this. But it's like you're finding a person that's like new to the game that somehow nails it across the boards. All the performances are amazing. And I also have to point to Zweibelman and the two leads who were very operative as the showrunners of the show. Gabe Liebman was the showrunner sort of supervising them, but I think they also were sort of co-showrunners. So, but whoever was handling the performances on set, and I know Maya and Anna did a lot of it, just amazing work getting these moments and these performances, and Becca being a perfect example, mm-hmm, to have the nuances of enjoying it while also
telling
just
the
communicating
truth,
this information.
Yeah. There's a New Yorker article that I was reading today about the whole thing.
Yeah, I read that article too.
In which they said that little girl was such a nice kid, and they always felt a little guilty about, you know, making her be such a jerk to them on the show. And she was like apologizing to them, and, you know, it was like, it must be just a weird dynamic. I mean, first of all, working with kid actors is always a weird dynamic, but just a weird dynamic to make some little kid play like an evil, bitchy kid, when in fact they're not like that at all in real life, you know.
She's doing a great job. She's going to get typecast in it for the rest of her days.
Just how Hollywood works. So yeah, so we're out on that, and Maya doesn't know what to do, so she does what you do in a situation like that, which is they go to see Shuji and find out how to fight back.
And this is another example of a great mislead, because when he hears that she's been called Eugis, He sort of stands up and his blood runs cold. And you're like, oh, wow, we're in one of these things. And then it's just he's gonna tell her how to, in their words, bitch out.
Well, he
Dustin
says, and, he goes, I'm not going to beat up a seventh grader, which, by the way, was not my experience in seventh grade.
Right.
There were plenty of eighth graders that were perfectly happy to do that.
Do you think that's they're making a distinction of like that Shuji is more honorable, or that's just the
no,
rules
I
of
think,
the school?
I think it's more just like that's how that school is,
right.
And it's the world they're setting up. You
gotcha.
Know? But just to go back a little bit, my favorite part of that whole scene is, I forget which one of them says it, but she's like, do you know where the eighth graders sit? And they start walking towards the eighth graders, and you see this one girl dancing like she's at a rave. Like, it just sets such a funny tone for, like, oh, now we're in the eighth grade part of the world.
Yeah, you know? Entering the cave in the hero's journey.
Right. But yeah, so Shuji says, here's a couple things you can say.
Right.
And it's very funny that she still can't get over how adorable this kid is. He's like, what is he like? And she starts describing his beautiful silken chestnut
bad
hair.
Features. Yeah, yeah. And this is another thing that's sort of so interesting and unique about these two as characters that also feels true, that they're very boy crazy. And that's sort of a driving aspect of it, because they connect their boy craziness and their interest in boys to their path to adulthood and becoming young women. And so they're singularly focused on it. But there's also doesn't seem to be a loyalty to their crushes. Mm-hmm. Maya's, you know, is sort of like open to either Dustin or Brandt. Like, whoever's going to fill the slot. And Anna likes Shoji, but also
Alex.
Alex, exactly. So it's very, I don't know, it's very, I really love that aspect of it.
Which is, like you said, very true to life.
Right.
Like, no one cares at that age. It's just like, who do I like today?
Right.
And it's devastating if they don't like me back, but tomorrow there'll be somebody else.
Right.
Which is nice.
Which also gives you the sort of the dual story you're telling of, this is the most important thing that ever happened, and will be traumatic the rest of my life.
And it's completely inconsequential.
Exactly.
Yeah. So then we have Maya's all set up to confront them after school. She tells the kids in a class, like, I'm going to go after him after school. We'll see what happens. And the showdown occurs.
Yes. Which, interestingly, having watched Freaks and Geeks recently, similar showdown. And it's always sort of like, oh, we're doing this trope. What is our spin on it? And the spin is great. A, in that it's a girl, a 13-year-old girl facing a 13-year-old boy. And then sort of that's unusual, that it's a bitch out sort of contest. And then also that, obviously, the specifics of how it plays out, in that, you know, Maya's clearly freaking out. She can't get her words together. She's sort of just riding on energy. Anna's sort of pushing her into it.
The weird physicality the two of them have is very entertaining. Like, almost like corner men in a boxing match.
Yes.
Circling back and forth. And like, Anna's behind Maya and yelling at her to go do it, get it, you know, whatever. And
which you can imagine them also being distinct from the kids around them, even if they actually were 13-year-olds, and that's why these two are different, is that they're sort of weirdos and jacked up in energy, uh-huh. And, you know.
Whereas the kid is just complete, like a statue, like, right. Doesn't know what's going on.
Even though he
on,
provoked it.
Does not
still
understand what's happening.
Right.
And it's set up, I think, pretty well by the whole previous scene that we didn't talk about, which was when Maya got asked to tell people what she had done over the summer, and
right.
She goes into a whole Ace Ventura riff.
Which is a bold choice to include in the pilot, because it is off story, other than it's really fantastic misdirection, in that it's sort of like, you're like, oh, maybe she is going to become popular. Maybe this is going to play in.
And it's right. Like, all the kids are laughing at what she's doing. They're all on board with how funny her impression is. And
right.
You get a sense of her as a performer. Although then they come back and she's kind of looking, she's like triumphantly going back to her desk after doing this great performance.
Yeah.
And looking at Brandt, and he has just no reaction, just complete, even though he was laughing while she was up there,
right.
It's like it was a different person, and now she's back to being herself. But I'm only bringing that up because I feel like that sets up her weird performative energy in the moment of the fight, because she's clearly a performer of some kind.
100%. And then there's the turn, which is also, this is again, it's like, okay, this is their specific of how to turn this trope on its head. And the thing that's most impressive is the thing that Brandt and Dustin have done is so off the charts, cruel, and unforgivable,
mm-hmm.
That it's like, well, there's no way you're going to turn this back on its head and have Maya
they're not going to win.
Have this blow up in Maya's face. Right. If she'll the only thing that can happen is that the bully wins, and they make her the worst bully by invoking that Brant's father has recently passed away
because of stuff Brant did.
Right.
And this is a thing I think a lot of people don't get sometimes, is you have to drop this stuff in earlier. Like, you can't just come out of nowhere, because it feels too sitcom-y of like, oh, wait, but they do say, I forget who says it, but somebody says something about how he did something when his dad was sick or something like that earlier on. So we know that the dad was sick. We don't know until this moment that the dad died, but it totally fits together with everything we already know. It's not just out of nowhere.
And then the crowd immediately turns on Maya, and the things that are the most amazing is that they're not even shouting at Maya. They're just quietly objecting.
They can't believe it.
Hey, that's not, what are you doing? That's not. And as they walk away, the quiet audio that I love is Dustin, the other monster in this situation, you know, just like going, hey, it's okay, man.
Comforting. Okay.
Just comforting Brant.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic.
So she manages to lose this incredibly winnable confrontation. And then we get back to where we were at the beginning of the pilot, which is that they're in their rooms or whatever. And she gets the note from Shuji about how he's proud of her, and with the map to where the list is, so she can take her name off the list of Ujis.
Now, I'm curious what your reaction was to this, and I don't know, you've watched it several times, so maybe you don't remember, but my reaction to this, and I don't necessarily need a win, like, you could have ended the show on them walking away from the fight, but it feels like it's like, there's obviously the kind of joke that's like, oh my god, it's this thing, and like, whoa, she knows what it is, what is it? They go into the bathroom, and she scratches her, or tries to scratch her name off. She doesn't really effectively scratch her name off because it's carved into the wall. It doesn't really change anything in terms of what's happened. So is it supposed to show the futility of scratching it off or going to this gesture? Mm-hmm. Like, what is the purpose of that scene?
I think it is supposed to show that she is able to get a win out of it.
It is supposed to feel like a win.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's not a bleak existential comment on how no matter what we do, we're going to fail. I think it's more like, this is where your name would have gone, and you are defacing that. So, yeah, I get what you're saying, that it doesn't really get rid of the marks on the wall, but nobody's going to go in there next year and go, I know who you just was last year, you know?
Aren't they? They can read the name.
I see it as they cut away to the outside of the bathroom. She's still scratching at the wall. She kept scratching at the wall after that for a few more seconds so that it was illegible. So if you really wanted to see her name, you'd have to go in with some sort of acid etching solution, like a CSI person,
right,
and go, what was underneath this scratch here? And then you'd be like, oh, last year's Ujis was Maya Ishii Peters. I think it is ultimately a victory for them that they got what they wanted, which is she's not the Ujis, you know. She was able to cross it out.
We'll never know unless we speak to one of the creators.
I know. I'm quite certain. So there it is, Pen 15. Check it out. See what you think. Oh, hopefully you already watched it, because otherwise you don't have to, since we already went through the whole thing.
I have a question for you too. Do you think there was a B story in the episode?
Oh, good question.
No.
I mean, I guess the A story and the B story are both of their stories. So, like, you could argue the...
I would argue that it's just Maya's story.
But Alex is another thing for Anna. And.
But plays into the B story, like, is really...
But that's following a different...
Is it?
Romance.
I mean, certainly it's following a different romance. That doesn't make it a different story, necessarily.
I was actually more invested in the Anna-Alex story, because that one seems like it could have legs, whereas you sort of feel from the jump with the Maya story, it's like, oh, this is going to turn out badly, because this is clearly some kind of
prank.
Oh,
the Alex
prank.
Story does have legs, but it's not in this episode.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I feel like that's why it's a separate story. I win.
But we're talking about a single episode. We're not talking about the series. We're talking about the pilot. There's an A story in this pilot. There is not a B story.
Yeah, but we're talking about a serialized series wherein plots are ongoing.
Oh, are we talking about a serialized series?
I believe we are.
Oh, okay. But where does the story go? So what are the beats of that story?
The beats of that story are she sees him. Is he the one who's... Was it Brandt or...
Already it's not a good story as far as I'm concerned.
The plot with Alex doesn't have closure because it's a serialized series. But it begins the journey. So you have to judge each episode by, well, what stories, what strains of plot are you following?
I disagree 100%.
Not even 90%.
Not 90%, 100%.
100%, we'll see.
The only reason the Anna and Alex stuff works in this episode is because it plays into Maya's story.
I'm not saying thematically they're not tied. I'm saying I think you could consider it a B plot.
I think you're coming at it from a lot of different directions. And I think for a B story to work, it needs to have a beginning, middle, and end. And that doesn't have that in this episode.
I don't think it has to have a beginning, middle, and end. And if you did, you could argue that the end is when he sees the two of them be, in their minds, cruel to Brandt. And so she sort of made some ground with Alex, and then she loses it at the end.
You're saying the fact that he happens to be at the moment that Maya fights the other kid,
he comments
makes completion of his story.
He comments. I don't remember exactly what he says, but he comments of just like basically it's not cool what's happening here, and they're clearly in league with each other, Maya and Anna.
Right, but if the story is about him and Anna's relationship, that doesn't really have anything to do with his relationship with Anna.
Yeah, it does. It puts her behind the eight ball with it.
I feel like you're being very general in your definition of story here.
I don't think that's it. To me, it's like, because you depart from the Maya story, mm-hmm. and you follow the Anna story. And the sizes of the story determine whether it's the A story or the B story. So you're departing from the Maya story, and then you're going into the doctor's office with Anna and Alex, which is the B story.
You're going into the doctor's office, which is, by the way, a nurse's office.
Well, I'm trying to give that nurse credit. We don't know how far she went in medical school.
She could
have
been a physician's assistant.
Yes.
I don't even know if it's a woman. But... the reason you go there is to get information for Maya, not to do anything that has anything to do with Anna's story.
Well, you could argue that's why it's well-written serialization, because they don't depart from it entirely. But I do feel like the emotional beat you're following there is how is it going for Anna with Alex?
I don't think that matters in that moment, because all she cares about is getting back to Maya and telling her that Dustin's a bitch.
I mean, I never would have thought that this was the moment that this podcast ended, because Sean and I came to blows so harshly over which teenage romance.
It's wild, because I know we both have done the same thing for a long time in terms of writing for television, but for you to be so wrong about something like this blows my mind.
It's like watching a baby try to drive and just, you know, just having problems and not being able to reach the wheel. And that's watching you try to make this point is what that feels like.
It's just interesting that you would hold on so hard to an argument that's so clearly incorrect.
This is a sad way for this podcast to end on one of us being terribly wrong. And I'm pretty sure if you go to the polls, you'll find out which one on our website.
Yeah.
Which is...
please vote at 1-800-555-COPILOTS.
The reason I brought that up is when I was watching the show, I am drawn as a viewer into the Anna Alex relationship, but in Sean's framework, this was not a B story, because I was like, there's no climax, there's no act break on it, there's no complication or backfiring.
Smart guy.
But also,
he's just reiterating what you said.
But also, to your point, they don't play it as, like, I think you're being uncharitable to Andy when you say at the end he just happens to be there. Like, they zoom in on his reaction to Anna in particular, and I think that's like one of the last things of the episode is him being disappointed with her.
He is a smart guy, Sean. You're right.
I think laying in story for later episodes is very different from having a story in this episode.
In a serialized show, it has to be laying in.
Well, I guess the question is, does it matter? Like, does it matter whether you call it B story or A story? Because I've never been in a writing room.
All of these terms are really, their main purpose is for, speaking as the writers, our way of thinking about the story and discussing the story and figuring out if something's not working, why it's not working. So all these structural ways of sort of slotting it in your head, that's the purpose of it. That being said, this is a very intuitive pilot, even though it's structured very well, again, because of how it's probably created and all the iterations they went through. So if it's working, then you, I don't think you necessarily have to break it down into this way or that way. On the other, I don't know, it's very interesting to look at particularly modern serialized shows and figure out the kind of things we're talking about, like whether they're going to classic structure or whether they're not, and how confident they are to depart and from that, and how well it works when they do. Because I agree with the spirit of what Sean's saying, which is if you depart too far from it, you certainly are increasing the odds of having it not be a satisfying conclusion or finish or development of your story.
I didn't even feel like I was looking for a satisfying conclusion to that story.
And I'm not saying it needed it in order to be a B-plot.
I'm saying it does.
Right? That's where we disagree.
So would you say Shuji's story is a story in this as well?
No, because Maya is the central character in that story, even the Shuji parts. So that is part of Maya's journey. Whereas Maya is not the central character in Anna's story with Alex.
But she kind of is, especially in the big moment where they have their conversation in the nurse's office.
She is the thing they're talking about, but she's not the emotional center of that story.
I'm not going to move you off your point, and you're not going to move me off mine.
I knew that about 15 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm.
One last new segment I'm going to throw at you and see how it works is, and I have not watched any more of the show, who would you pick as the first character to die? And why?
Now, obviously, I don't know what happens in the series, but to me, the darkest comedic thing to happen would be Brandt remains a tormentor of Maya or Anna. They turn on him again in some public way, and then he dies in some way. So it's escalating what they've already done in mocking him about his father's death.
I feel like I can't participate in this one because
you know what happens.
I've already watched the show.
Oh, I don't want it spoiled, so don't say.
Right, so I won't say anything.
But I will say this: this has kind of made me think of what I actually thought you were going to say to end our meandering argument. Is should we have some kind of an outside electronic decision point of like if Sean and I are having an intractable argument? Then the computer just decides which one of us is right in a randomized fashion. We go, well, I guess I was wrong. Sean was right.
Just a spinner like the one you have for the other thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a spinner.
You could have spinners for different things.
I just like the sound of the spinner, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I love it. I can do that.
Oh, you're going to do it right now? Ha-ha! Secunda!
Well, I guess I lose according to Kevin's laptop, the ultimate arbiter of all things.
If only we could decide all geopolitical issues with Kevin's laptop.
Shall we play a game?
I think it was a
folks,
B-plot, Professor Falcon.
This has been Copilots.
Thank you for listening to everyone. And you know what? Do you like our show? Or you know the other option is that you could love our show. Either way, give us 5 stars, leave us a comment. We're going to be selecting some of those. You know, honestly, good, bad, whatever. You're still going to get your pilot's wings, which is, that's a fake thing. That's not a real thing. But spiritually.
Wait, so it doesn't exist.
There are no pilot's wings. Okay, that will
I'm
be
getting
sent.
a lot of questions about that, and I don't know how to answer.
I really tried to be clear. This is just a metaphorical set of wings that you will get. Just by leaving a 5-star review, you can say whatever you want. Just give us 5 stars. Here's an example.
Yes, this review is from someone named A Rabid Fan, and the review is titled Jolly Good Show. And it is a 5-star review which says, I used to watch a sewage pipe drip onto these guys while they performed improv comedy in a supermarket basement. I hadn't thought about those old times for years, but now that this podcast has debuted, it really has me wondering about what became of that old pipe. I hope it was fixed or replaced.
Obviously referring to the UCB theater, which Sean and I performed in for many years in New York.
Did you ever, there was in fact a pipe that sort of hung over the stage that sometimes would have odd things coming out of it, or there'd be a bag on the end of it. Did you ever get any?
I got dripped on, yeah, for sure. In those times.
I think I successfully avoided getting dripped on, but I did.
Well,
I
you usually performed most of the shows staring in fear at the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So,
or I stayed all the way on the other, you know, I very much stayed to the perimeter of the stage.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, I always started every scene by going, I'm outside.
Hello,
I'm on the ledge.
Hello, I'm at the bottom of the mountain down here.
I'm in the audience watching your show. Jolly good show.
I'm in an air balloon off to the side.
So it's really a good thing your motorcycle has a huge sidecar.
So no, Sean didn't get... I wonder what became of that pipe too. You know what? Maybe I wonder if that pipe got a deal on CISO at some point. Who knows?
I mean, this person says they're a rabid fan. They're clearly British, right? Because it says Jolly Good Show. That would put them... In 19th century Victorian England. I just don't know that was the direction I want our reviews to go in, is like to the piping in an old theater that we performed at.
Well, see, the brilliance is, Sean, as long as they give us 5 stars, then we're not allowed to block, you know.
We now have to send them wings, right?
Like, no, we're not sending them anything. But you have your wings, rabid fan. Good job also getting rabid fan and not rabid fan. 1967 or
this whatever. Is the first time anybody's ever used the name Rabid Fan.
Yeah, apparently so.
Okay, so we are going to keep releasing episodes of the show on the first and third Sundays of the month, just like this one today, which is on the one of those. And if you're looking for where to watch these pilots that we're doing, because some of them are pretty obscure, some of them are in weird places, just check the show notes and you can see where to watch. That's also where you will find links to our Patreon. We now have a Patreon and our social media. So go to @CoPilotsTV in any of those places if you want to support us. And we're going to have all sorts of great bonus content. In fact, I'm not thrilled with the decision that Kevin's laptop made, so I am thinking that perhaps we could do a little poll amongst our listeners as to whether Anna's story counts as a B story or whether Andy is wrong.
So you're demanding a recount, is what you're saying.
Well, I feel like it was rigged. I feel like I've actually won the election.
And that's it. Hey, everybody, you're all in the wrong seat. You're supposed to be in 23B. That's
all of them?
Yes, all of them. They're all seated in the wrong seat. Is it Metaphor Network? Hey, folks.
No, I just think if you say they're all supposed to be in 23B, that's going to be one crowded seat.
Yeah, that's right.
Please feel free to get up and move about the cabinet.
The cabinet?
What?
Did you say cabinet?
Yeah. Isn't that what they say on a plane?
The cabin. Is this an intentional pun?
I don't know.